Barbara Lee Diamonstein-Spielvogel was here last month to talk about a book from NYU Press called The Landmarks of New York, an illustrated comprehensive record of New York City's historic buildings. It's the definitive guide to New York's landmark buildings and historic districts. But since that visit, a number of new buildings in an historic district have received landmark status, so we have asked her back to talk about those new designations and also to answer some questions we didn't get to the last time. Ms. Diamonstein-Spielvogel is the founder and chair of the New York Landmarks 50 Alliance, chair of the Historic Landmarks Preservation Center, chair of the New York State Council on the Arts, and she was a member of the New York City Landmarks Preservation Commission for 17 years. Welcome back to our show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And I assume somewhere along the line some people are going to want to join the conversation. So let me give out the phone number. It's 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at wnyc.org/Lopate or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Your book includes a list of 95 sites heard but not designated. But 2 weeks ago, the commission voted on 13 sites. Were those the last from the backlog to be heard?
No, unfortunately, that list was sort of my hall of shame in that book, because most 85% of those landmarks were calendared for 20 or more years, and all of them were calendared prior to 2010.
Calendared so, means that after 2010, they won't be considered anymore?
No, calendared means they are now up for a review.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that is a very significant term. It's only a staff of 70 people that take care of all these 36,000 properties and all these historic districts.
Now, the commission voted to landmark 10 of the 13 nominees. What happened to the others? Are they put off for another time?
I think they have been, two of them probably have been put out to pasture. The 10 that were designated, shall I tell you which they
sure.
are? The St. Barbara's Roman Catholic Church on Bleecker Street in Brooklyn.
That's in Bushwick.
Yes.
Now, that's a beautiful church. Why has it taken so long for it to have been landmarked? It first came up for landmark status in 1980.
I agree with you. The next one is 183-195 Broadway, also in Brooklyn, only one of a small number of cast iron buildings that were constructed in that borough. So that was designated. Bergdorf Goodman at 754 Fifth Avenue was built in 1927-28. On the former location of the Vanderbilt Mansion, in fact, designed by then preeminent designer Eli Jacques Kahn.
Now, okay, so let's talk about that before we move on to some of the others. Why has that taken so long to be designated? Is it because once they're designated, you can't change them, and Bergdorf Goodman wanted to have certain flexibility?
Well, I think that's a misconception. When I wrote the first landmark book, the first edition was in 1988. There was no codified inventory, let alone description, photographs, context describing the landmarks. So there were then 800 individual landmarks and 52 historic districts, 70 interior landmarks. Altogether, there were 16,000 buildings. So here we are now, 28 years later. And just since the last edition in 2011, only 5 years, there have been more than 100 landmarks, new ones, that have been designated. But of greater impact, I think, is the Commission's actions in designating 30 new historic districts and historic district extensions. That represents a 30% increase over the past.
Now, in the case of the Bergdorf Goodman, is that the only of the well-known stores that has been designated? What about Macy's, Saks Fifth Avenue, Bloomingdale's? Are they landmarked?
Well, Saks is, and I think Abraham and Strauss in Brooklyn was. But here, one, it's not only, Bergdorf is not only an excellent example of modern classical design, but, and it's surely one of New York's premier retail establishments. It's been going on for a very long time.
But why was there opposition to landmarking it?
You know, that's a question that I can't answer. In a country of private property rights, you never know what the owner has in mind, what the owner conceives of as a particular lien in their property. All you have to do is look at these additions and see the thousands of additions, changes that are sympathetic to the original design of the building that have occurred since Landmark's designation. You know, in my mind, there are two cases that are landmarks in and of themselves. Way back in the 1980s, on Madison Avenue, what were then called the Villard Houses, was a very long and protracted, heated argument. In fact, it was one of the few times that I'm aware of that the commissioners themselves were held responsible and sued rather than, you know, another entity.
They actually cut off the back of the Villard Houses to connect it to a new hotel that was built next door.
They didn't cut off the back. What they did was put, after a long, we kept the Villard Houses. They are a lovely addition. But what happened after this protracted personal as well as public assault on everyone, the very first thing they did when they started to build the hotel, it is advertised as a landmark hotel. So they know it confers a special value. I think someplace in my papers that I brought today was the second most recent example of that. Because everything old is new again. The same arguments that we had more than 50 years ago are being brought up actually innocently now. The current one, about 10 days ago, there was a full-page ad welcoming in the future, I hope many, new visitors, diners, to the new Four Seasons restaurant. I don't have to tell any of your listeners, because I know they're very well informed, how long and protracted that battle was. It was an entire full-page ad in the New York Times.
That was the restaurant inside the Seagram building.
Yes.
That was designed, well, the Seagram building is Mies van der Rohe, but the restaurant was designed by Philip Johnson. And that's why it was felt that it should be designated as a landmark.
It was designated as a landmark. Again, after a protracted battle, because there were many interior features, like the Richard Lippold over the bar and the pool. It is one of the loveliest rooms in New York.
So they're not messing around with it?
Well, they cannot go but so far. They auctioned off all that furniture, all by the most distinguished designers and everything else. They've renamed the hotel, the rooms, and I wish them every possible success. Are you ready?
What's the name?
The Landmark Rooms. So obviously they think it confers a special status, and I would agree with them. I hope they're frequently used by diners, happy diners, and I hope the food is up to the standard. Now, the original Four Seasons Hotel has kept its name, and it is going with a brand new design in consultation with the eminent architecture critic Paul Goldberger to completely design a new space at 48th Street and Park Avenue. So I think that might take a little bit longer That will be called the Four Seasons Restaurant on 48th Street. And on 52nd Street, it will be the Landmark Rooms, the Grill Room and the Bar Room.
It is odd when these restaurants are forced to move. The Union Square restaurant was forced to move away from Union Square. It's now on 19th Street and Park Avenue, but it's still called the Union Square. My guest is Barbara Lee Diamonstein Spielvogel. We're talking about the landmarking process in New York, what has already been landmarked, but also what is just being landmarked. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. One building that's still on the calendar, the IRT Powerhouse on 12th Avenue between 58th and 59th Street, was designed by Stanford White, and yet it has not been landmarked?
You are correct.
Well, and what's the problem there?
There is another building that is designed by a very distinguished interior, Alvar Aalto, and that, among the 13 brought forward, were two that were not designated. I don't know what the issues involved are, but I can't imagine. I frankly can't imagine a valid reason. And I, even though they are not designated under this new rule, I think they can't be heard for a certain period of time, but I assume they wouldn't dare do anything. But surely there are some plans for that gorgeous powerhouse.
Well, that's been brought up since in 1979, 1990, yes. 2009, 2015, now this year. Do you think that the designation was opposed by Con Edison, which is now using the building? Or is it used? Is it owned by the city?
I don't know. But it is certainly a major controversy, but it is a gorgeous building.
You mentioned
a wonderful museum.
Yeah, well, it's Stanford. It seems to me anything by Stanford White should be should automatically be landmarked. He was a very great architect, and he put a stamp on his stamp on the city as a growing historical experience. You mentioned the St. Barbara's Roman Catholic Church, which is a Spanish Baroque revival building in Bushwick. And I'm assuming that the reason that it finally was landmarked is because the neighborhood is gentrifying, and now there's concern that this building might very well be endangered.
I imagine you are quite correct once again. But there are a number of buildings like that. For example, the Lowe's 175th Street Theater is one of the Wonder Theaters that was built for the Lowe's movie chain during the late 1920s. It's a Thomas Lamb building, but I think it was first built in response to the construction that was spurred by building the George Washington Bridge. But it's a very exuberant, eclectic style. And it finally has been designated. That's at Upper Broadway.
Another new landmark is the Jackie Robinson YMCA Youth Center on West 135th Street, which was built in 1919. Are buildings like that designated for their cultural significance or for the beauty of their architecture?
Well, sometimes for both. In fact, there is an increased tendency to emphasize who lived there, what went on there. And I think that is valid.
So even if a building is undistinguished, well, they often wind up with a plaque, and that's another part of what you discuss in your book. And that's also part of the landmarking process. The buildings themselves aren't necessarily anything to remark about.
Well, for example, sometime early next year, the Historic Landmark Preservation Center will install a plaque at a ceremony honoring the 100th anniversary of the birth of Leonard Bernstein at the Osborne on 57th Street. That is still occupied by many distinguished, celebrated, remarkable contributors to all of the arts, particularly music, and I think that will be a particularly festive occasion because many people are anxious to honor him. Next year, too, is the centennial of the birth of Ella Fitzgerald. So the Historic Landmark Preservation Center will honor her. We have been on a quest to honor Walt Whitman in Brooklyn, and he lived in many residences for several years now. But before we can do that, it requires the permission of the owner of the building.
And they wouldn't want to have a cultural medallion that said Walt Whitman lived here. I would think that would immediately increase the value of the building.
Well, I would agree with you, but people are very tentative. There are many heirs involved in this building. An estate has not been settled, but I do hope that they can resolve this, because I'd like it to happen in time for the opening of Crossings, that wonderful opera by a 25-year-old Matthew O'Coyne that will be at the Brooklyn Academy of Music next fall, and I thought it would be nice to do it simultaneously.
That Crossings based on Walt Whitman's writings. There are cultural medallions for a wide range of people, James Baldwin, Mark Twain, Houdini, Edward Hopper, George Gershwin, Miles Davis, W.H. Auden. In fact, if you go, you Google cultural medallions, you'll see that there's a huge cluster in Manhattan, a fair number in Brooklyn, a few in Queens and the Bronx, not too many in Staten Island, even though some of the most distinguished historic buildings are in Staten Island. Is it just assumed that nobody's going to knock them down?
No. The cultural medallion program is a part not of the Landmarks Commission, but the Historic Landmark Preservation Center, an organization which coincidentally I chair, that was established to honor distinguished men and women in every field who made New York what New York is. So there are people in Staten Island that are honored. If I recall, Nikola Tesla, I think, lived in Staten Island and several others, and we're always eager to learn of more. Sometimes it is the occupant or the neighborhood or the historic district council that will nominate someone. If your listeners are interested, if they would look up HLPC cultural medallions, they will see the very simple process of nominating something, someone, verifiable information.
What are the criteria? Must the person have died, lived at the address for a significant amount of time, or created an important work there?
You've just described it. Thank you. And if they just can identify verifiable information. No, George Washington slept here. He certainly was a busy fellow. But we're eager to have as much diversity as we can in and who we represent. And some of it must come from the neighborhoods.
A listener wonders why there aren't any buildings or landmarks that honor Billie Holiday. Or I was thinking Thelonious Monk. If we have Miles Davis, why not Thelonious Monk?
Well, it's interesting. I've tried to do both of them, but it's not always the fault of the deceased or this organization. You need to have permission. In fact, the daughter of Thelonious Monk has been very involved with us in trying to seek approval to install. So it's a longer pursuit that than I would hope it had to be.
It's amazing that we have to fight these fights. We should be proud of our history.
I think so, too.
Barbara Lee Diamondstein-Spielvogel, the sixth edition of her book, The Landmarks of New York, an illustrated comprehensive record of New York City's historic buildings, has recently been released by NYU Press. It keeps on growing, obviously, because we keep on landmarking, and now we have landmarked a few more this year, which is what we are discussing. We will continue our conversation after this. And we are back with Barbara Lee Diamondstein-Spielvogel, author of, among other things, The Landmarks of New York, an illustrated comprehensive record of New York City's historic buildings, now in its sixth edition from NYU Press. She is also the founder and chair of the New York Landmarks 50 Alliance, chair of the Historic Landmarks Preservation Center, chair of the New York State Council on the Arts, and was a member of the New York City Landmarks Preservation Commission for 17 years. There's a new historic district, the South Village Sullivan Thompson Historic District. Is this a part of the village that hadn't previously been landmarked, adjacent to a whole bunch of areas that were?
That designation required 10 years of continuous effort by the remarkable executive director of the Greenwich Village Historic Society and his devoted followers. 10 years. And there is still another little piece that they hope to add to that. But it does make it a complete whole.
That's Andrew Berman?
It's Andrew Berman, and he's a very activist and very informed and passionate. And I wish more and more people followed his lead. I just think stronger together is a motto that works for everything, but especially for preservationists. You can't go this alone. And when you realize there are now 36,000 buildings that we're talking about, does that sound like a lot to you?
Not in a city like New York.
York is once again correct. There are over a million properties in New York, and that's less than 3.5% of the property, but some of the most valuable and surely some of the most interesting. People come to New York to see those buildings, to get the whole fabric and fiber of the city. Sometimes I see photos of New York and people are walking briskly along and not observing. I think they observe more than passersby think. I think New Yorkers are extremely friendly, curious, and helpful.
But other people are delighted. I was on the subway recently, got out at 49th Street, and there was this Italian family that was had been on the subway, asked for directions, and they came out, and they turned and looked at the lights of Times Square, and the delighted look on their face is something that is just hard to describe. But I'm sure that happens every day with thousands and thousands of people.
It does.
And not only Times Square, to all sorts of places in the city.
And in each of the five boroughs, there are wonderful magnets. I don't have to tell you or your listeners how important cultural tourism is to the economy of New York, how many people are employed, how many millions and millions and millions of dollars are generated, how many tens of thousands of jobs. I have some statistics that I can quote. But I think they have an idea of how great that impact is, and it is surely the way of the future.
How are historic districts defined? Are people starting to organize in some areas that have been targeted by developers to protect historic buildings
in their
neighborhoods?
There may be some of that, but I think, excuse me, more and more New Yorkers really love their neighborhoods. There isn't a place from 10th Avenue to river that you could not find a safe place to live. I think that's partly due to landmarks and historic districts in great measure. There's been such a revival both of the building stock, of interest in neighborhoods, of civic involvement and participation from... And that's one of the things, by the way, that really engaged me about the entire historic preservation movement. It cuts across all age groups, all economic groups. You just have to have a passion for human dignity and beauty and history.
What does landmarking an entire district do? Does it mean that every building within the area is landmarked?
No, they're not landmarked.
So developers can still buy up buildings
They certainly have. But at least there are design experts who are helping guide height and density, which is a real concern. I think we're about to 8.7 million residents, headed towards 9 million. And recently I passed by the Brooklyn Bridge and saw the infill of the stores and some swinging rusty doors that had offices, thinking that with the density that we have, one of these days every infill will be a haven for something, someplace. What will we do with fire escapes that can no longer be used? More importantly, what about fireplaces? Fire escapes are used, but fireplaces aren't. What will they be used for? But there is a place for every inch of New York. In fact, one of the things that it is said makes New York, New York, is its density. There's a recent exhibition that is worthy of everyone's attention at the Museum of the City of New York about what makes New York, New York, and they point out four important factors, the first being finances. From its very beginning, it was a center of money, 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 to its current occupation and preoccupation with money, money, money. The second is density. The third is diversity. And the fourth that particularly engages me is creativity. And we must do all we can to nurture, keep, make affordable places for artists of every kind in the visual, performing, literary arts, all the support systems. We need places for people to live. We need those empty storefronts turned into artist studios, into rehearsal spaces, making it profitable, at least doing good and well for the owner of the property as well as the person who occupies it.
Are these your concerns as the newly appointed chair of the New York State Council on the Arts?
It's a perfect segue. The newly appointed, believe it or not, is more than 8 months already. You know, New York had the first state arts council. Other places claim city arts councils like Winston-Salem, North Carolina. They all predate New York, as do preservation commissions. But in 1960, State Senator McNeil Mitchell, at the direction of Governor Nelson Rockefeller, helped found the New York State Council on the Arts, and it was the first state arts council. Is that name Mitchell familiar to you?
Mitchell-ama.
Exactly. And I've often thought that was a very sympathetic choice. Here was somebody who wanted good housing for everyone, who then helped provide funding for the arts for everyone. So Mr. Mitchell, Senator McNeil Mitchell, but surely with very strong support from Governor Rockefeller. So the first grants were in 1960. That is 56 years ago. Am I counting that correctly? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Can you guess how much it was?
Probably a half a million or something.
Well, we have 62 counties, and we had a lot of residents then, too. Everyone was so pleased. It was $50,000.
Oh, $50,000.
Yes.
Gee, I was over.
Yes. I wish you were on the funding commission. But by 1976, NISCA had a budget of $35 million and was a major source of arts funding in the New York area. But we serve all 62 counties and the 20 million people. But we need more applicants, and NISCA is always there to provide assistance in filling out applications. I'm amazed and delighted how superior the staff of NISCA is. Very committed, very well informed, and eager to help.
I invited calls. Allison from Manhattan, you're on the air.
Oh, yeah, hi. First of all, thanks to Barbara Lee for all this work for the city. I am born in Manhattan and, you know, living here for my whole life practically. And I do walk around the city. I have to say I am an Upper East Sider, not my preferred choice, but and I walk down 71st Street or 70th and, you know, look at all the beautiful townhouses. And while, you know, I totally cannot afford to live there and I have a little chip on my shoulder about those who can, I have to admit that it is very beautiful, and in all over the city. I mean, I can't quite remember. There's even 83rd Street between 1st and York. You know, these tenement buildings that I feel like I'm a tourist, really, walking around, and I do invite my fellow city dwellers to stop and appreciate what we have in this city. The new buildings, I'm not such a fan of, but, you know, life goes on.
Can I throw in, Allison, the housing stock in Harlem, for example, especially along where Marcus Garvey Park is. And there's the housing stock in Bed-Stuy, the housing stock, of course.
There are designated buildings in all of those areas.
But what about the parks? Some of the parks have also been designated as scenic landmarks.
Yes.
Central Park, Prospect Park, Fort Tryon. What about the smaller ones like Tompkins Square, Washington Square,
some
or Marcus
of the smaller
Garvey?
Ones
or
also.
McGolrick Park?
There are fewer, but to give you an idea of the enormity, and of course, the prime example is Central Park. To think of 847 acres right in the beating heart of New York City, larger than the entire Mediterranean municipality of Monaco. There we have it in Central Park, the result of a competition that was held, and it is one of the beauties of New York.
Well, how does landmarking affect what they can do in a park?
Every bridge, every tunnel, every statue, every walkway, every bench, excuse me, everything in all of Central Park is designated as one landmark. The same thing with
Prospect Park, I assume.
Excuse me, Prospect Park as well.
Now, there's also, what about the new ones, High Line or Governor's Island? Are they going to have to wait 30 years before do you need a cough drop?
I would love something.
Okay, we're almost finished anyway, Barbara Lee. But
thank you. The High Line, I'm proud to say that I was one of the founding directors, governs itself so strictly that I think we'll do pretty well till it becomes 30 years old. But it is already considered by most New Yorkers a landmark. It's surely one of the most visited, vibrant places that has reinvigorated all kinds of neighborhoods. But they will be the landmarks of tomorrow. And while you are not so keen on some architecture that is built today, you might look at some of these year-end reviews of the best buildings of the year. There have been a lot of wonderful buildings mixed in with the things that all of us sort of wrinkle our nose at. But some of the buildings that we fight for now, like the Seagram Building and the Lever Building, were the very impetus of the landmarks building. You know, these plain, what were considered plain glass and steel boxes, are now citadels of modern design.
Well, of course, they are good examples of modern architecture. There's a lot of bad examples of modern architecture in New York as well. What are your thoughts about the competing projects for the new Penn Station?
Oh, I think that will happen. I hope that will happen. And I think the Michael Kimmelman Chabarty plan was very thoughtful.
They were on our show to talk about it.
Oh, great. Because they're both very gifted thinkers and planners. And I think that what they've said should be very much incorporated. But I think Governor Cuomo has very big plans, as he mentioned in a recent speech, to turn New York State into the building that it had in the past. He maintains, and I agree with him, that is what has made New York so great.
We don't have any time left, but I've been thinking about what the city might look like if we hadn't landmarked some of these great treasures. In the old days, we just knocked things down and put other things in their place, whether they were beautiful or not. I don't know whether Penn Station was the ultimate impetus for that change, as some people have suggested. But whatever is the reason, We have to be very grateful that we have this sense of history in this city. And my great thanks to Barbara Lee Diamondstein Spielvogel, who has played such an important role in maintaining that sense of history, also has given us from NYU Press, the Landmarks of New York, an illustrated comprehensive record of New York City's historic buildings, now in its sixth printing. Thank you so much for being on our show again.